This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The natural world is disappearing. Species extinction rates are now 1,000 times higher than they were before the spread of humanity. Unless we move quickly to protect global biodiversity, we will soon lose most of the species composing life on Earth. Currently, about 15% of the land and 3% of the oceans are protected. We have to increase that. Only by committing half of the planet's surface can we hope to halt the decline.
How much of the planet does nature need to keep on going? It's a big question. In 2017, famed American biologist E.O. Wilson said we need to protect half of Earth to avoid a deadly mass extinction of species. That has been refined as the Global Deal for Nature, and one of the architects of that deal is Dr. Eric Dinnerstein. For 25 years, Eric was chief scientist at the World Wildlife Fund, or WWF. He is now with the NGO called Resolve. He leads their program on biodiversity and wildlife solutions. And I think this may be our best and last chance to save nature. From Washington, D.C., Eric Dinnerstein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on.
What are conservation plans like this one trying to avoid?
I think that what we're trying to avoid is climate breakdown and massive biodiversity loss that will lead to major extinctions in our time, and to create essentially a livable biosphere that we can hand on to future generations.
So why do we need to save so much land and sea for nature to operate kind of without us?
You know, it would be really helpful right from the beginning if, starting from this show, your listeners can start to think of climate and biodiversity together in the same sentence. And that's critical because what the latest science is telling us, both atmospheric science and biodiversity science, is that the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis are interlinked, and we cannot save biodiversity without maintaining a stable climate, and we can't avoid climate breakdown unless we save biodiversity. So that's kind of the biggest headline. Now, under that is a basic truth, a fact that's come from atmospheric sciences, is that half of all, some estimate 50%, some say 60%, but let's say more than half of all the greenhouse gas emissions that are induced by, generated by humans, are absorbed in our land sinks, in our ocean sinks. So we're getting this amazing ecosystem service for free, basically, by just maintaining natural habitat. If we lose a fair amount of habitat on land, we not only emit more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when forests burn, for example, or land is cleared and then burned, but also carbon, greenhouse gases can be released from the ground, like methane, particularly like up in Canada, in Alaska, or Russia, that areas of permafrost, if they melt as well, will start emitting greenhouse gases and create this extremely dangerous feedback loop that could threaten really all of nature and a good deal of humanity. So the simplest solution to trying to avoid climate breakdown and to save biodiversity is to protect half, to protect those carbon sinks and to protect the biodiversity that's in it.
Where does this number of half or 50% of Earth for nature come from? I mean, surely somebody didn't just pull it out of a hat. There must be some science behind it.
There is. So first, on the biodiversity side, what we did in the Global Deal for Nature, which we can get to. So the Global Deal for Nature is a time-bound, science-based approach to saving life on Earth. And it's time-bound in the sense that we have to do this on a fairly accelerated schedule, and it's science-based. So here is the science for the biodiversity part. We took all of the most widely used biodiversity data layers, so to speak, like where are all the birds, the mammals, the reptiles, amphibians, where are they found only in a single place? That's called endemism, so it's quite rare. Where are all the plants? And so we think of it as, how do we add these layers that then, when they're amalgamated, tell us from the computer analysis how much land we need and how much marine area do we need? And the answer comes up very close to 50%. So simply put, we need about 46% in our calculation for biodiversity and carbon storage, another 6% or so for additional climate stabilization, just to keep the natural vegetation intact. It doesn't require intensive management, just to avoid emissions. And then in a new paper we're doing that we're about to release, we asked a question that nobody has asked before. What would it take to connect all of the world's protected areas and intact habitats? And the answer to that is remarkably small, only about 2.8% of the Earth's surface. So you combine those three elements and you come to about 52% that's needed. And that can be a blueprint for saving life on land. And then in marine, there are other analyses that are ongoing now that show roughly between 30 and 50% are also needed. So that's where the number comes from. It's based on the best science that we have and the best rationales for what are the biodiversity targets we're trying to conserve.
Well, as you know, a new paper published in the journal Nature Sustainability offers a criticism, or at least a caution, about the global deal for nature. It was led by Dr. Judith Schleicher and co-authored by Chris Sandbrook of Cambridge, and he is our next guest. What did you think about their paper titled Protecting Half of the Planet Could Directly Affect Over 1 Billion People?
Well, we offer a counter perspective in the reply to that, which is that they have the number wrong, that protecting half the planet, let's turn that on its head. Not protecting half the planet could affect 7.8 billion people and the 10 billion people who likely will be on Earth by 2050, because we are all living in the same biosphere and we need to have clean air and we need to have a good living environment. This is the problem with that paper and papers that social scientists usually write. And if I could make a plea, I would just ask the social scientists, please don't skip over the atmospheric and biodiversity science like the Nature Sustainability critique does. By skipping over that, you're missing just the preamble I gave earlier in your show, that if we don't conserve 50% of land and marine areas, that we won't sequester the carbon that's needed to have a livable biosphere. So basically what we need to do to stay below 1.5 degrees C, which is the goal that every atmospheric scientist embraces now, and the UN panel as well, is we can get there if we apply nature-based solutions like the Global Deal for Nature, plus transition to renewable energy as fast as we can, but definitely by 2050. So there is a pathway here to have a thriving planet, a thriving life on Earth, but we have to act now. We can't wait till 2050. We're suggesting by 2030 to try to protect 30% at least on land and another 20% in what's called other important conservation areas, that many of which are indigenous lands, and we can touch upon that as well. But basically, the biggest critique is that they're missing the big picture here, is that if we don't do this, how are we going to avoid the climate catastrophe of environmental refugees, of the droughts that we see, the catastrophic forest fires we've seen in California and Australia, many linked to climate change, sea level rise? It's one thing to criticize something, and I totally understand that. That's a big part of academic life. But I'd like to hear some of the same academics. What answer do you have? What proposal do you have that could sustain life on Earth, given the crises that we face with climate breakdown and the loss of biodiversity? We're happy to listen and discuss that.
Some critics of the Global Deal for Nature complain about the cost of sealing away all those resources and lands, but you take on the cost of the deal in your paper, and it sounds like actually it's pretty inexpensive. You found about $100 billion a year in costs, but the U.S. spends $639 billion for military alone. So it doesn't seem like cost is that great compared to the threat we face.
It's not. Very good point, Alex. It's not the cost, it's the political will. So it would be about $100 billion a year. You know, it may be plus or minus $10 billion, but that's not so important. The other comparison besides the military is what fossil fuel subsidies are. And here are the fossil fuel industry getting subsidies to exacerbate the problem if we spent some of that even just on trying to maintain the natural habitats that would offset all those emissions, it would be a tremendous breakthrough. Yours was military. Mine is something like, I think just in the United States alone, we spend $33 billion a year on pet food and grooming. So it's not that big a price, you know, for the world to step up and do this. And we're working hard with a number of groups to try to find those resources quickly to make this big difference happen.
But I take your point. I mean, suppose it's true. It would be hard. It would be costly. It would be unpopular to save half the earth for the wild. But what is the other choice? What happens if we just pick a growth economy instead and plow ahead as we're doing?
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge. You know, when also people say it's going to be hard because let's go through some of the other complaints about the global deal for nature. And some are in the Schleicher and Sandburg paper, which are simply not true. They make assumptions about what's in the two papers they cite, of which I'm involved in. And the first is that making the assumption that we're trying to conserve 50% of every ecoregion. So there's 846 ecoregions in the world, terrestrial ecoregions. Alex, you're out there on the edge of British Columbia and the U.S. in the Okanagan, and so you're in the Okanagan dry forest. Isn't that more romantic to call it that than just B.C.? And we all live in an ecoregion. You can go to a map of the world at ecoregions2017.appspot.com, which we did with Google, and you can move the mouse around and find out what ecoregion you live in. Okay, if you scroll over to some of the places, like in Canada and the U.S., for example, where the major agricultural areas are, where you have row agriculture of wheat, corn, soybeans, we're never saying that we should try to maintain 50% or put into conservation 50% of all the world's ecoregions. That would be ludicrous in like the tall grass prairie of the United States and forking up into Canada. That's 98% corn and soybeans. So of the 846 ecoregions, there's 207 where the average amount of natural habitat remaining, protected or unprotected, is less than 20%. And for those 207 ecoregions, the average is only 4%. So these are heavily converted. They're the place of intensive food production. And we would never say, try and get these to 50%. Similarly, places that have huge population densities, all the metropolitan areas, before we do our analysis of where could we get to 50%, we filter out all the places where the cities and towns and major metropolitan areas. So that's another critique of the paper that you mentioned that's totally bogus, because I think they even mention that London would have to be put under conservation. Our message to Londoners is keep calm and carry on. That's just a mistake of their methods. We don't put London or Rome or Tokyo or New York or Vancouver or Los Angeles under conservation. You know, all those population areas are masked out. Even when you do that in the analysis, there's still plenty of land left. You know, in the United States, for example, 80% of people live in metropolitan areas. And it's an amazing map, if you've ever seen one, of a 3D map with mountains, very steep mountains that symbolize the densities of people per square mile. And it shows very large areas, even in the United States with, you know, over 300 million people, where there's plenty of opportunity for conservation. And that's true in a number of ecoregions. In fact, to get to half, there are over 100 ecoregions that have already exceeded 50% protection. We should get to indigenous lands, too, because I think that's another important point, but you might want to have another question.
Well, no, why don't you talk to us about indigenous lands? I do want to hear about that.
Sure. You know, I think that this is the other mistake that is in that paper, and really not that paper, but just sort of writ large, what other people who are social scientists or anthropologists criticize and assume that we want to take land away from indigenous groups. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's just the opposite. In fact, I would say that we are the biggest defenders of indigenous lands and indigenous people to have authority and to have the determination of what their lands should be used for, whether it's conservation or not. And fortunately, almost all of the response has been from indigenous groups. Is this an endorsement of the global deal for nature? I didn't attend the Convention on Biological Diversity scientific meeting, which is going on right now in Montreal, But what we've been told is that indigenous groups are firmly behind the global deal for nature because it recognizes the contribution that their lands are making to a sustainable biosphere, and it's in line with their way of thinking. You know, one of the things that we've always said about our Nature Needs Half initiative, Alex, is that there are three pillars. You know, one is climate science, and another is biodiversity science, but the third is indigenous knowledge and wisdom. One of our co-authors in this response to Schleicher and Sandbrook is not far from where you are, Julie Cajun. She's from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. And her point is that what she says is, like, our ancestors understood that a life of reciprocity with one another and our world was essential to well-being, not just for current generations in the world, but also for the unborn and the world of the future. Elders tell us that we are the youngest brother and sister of creation. Everything came before us. This perspective affords us humility, reverence, and understanding of the value of the natural world. It is troubling when conservation discussions focus primarily on human needs, and we would remind everyone again that we are the youngest and that we are dependent on the well-being of all that was here before us. Taking care of the natural world is taking care of us and thinking of our grandchildren and those to come. Let us consider that societal and human economic needs can best be addressed by more humane policies, laws, and governments. Nature Needs Half values nature and humanity. You know, and I would just add to that, that with the youth movements going on today, like Extinction Rebellion and the voice of Greta Thunberg and her colleagues, is that we should listen to the youth movements to sense in the injustice, because that's a term that the social scientists often use, the injustice of this bold idea of Nature Needs Half. But you can look at that again from a different perspective, the injustice that future generations will experience if we fail to respond by enacting big solutions now. And so it depends. I'd love to see, rather than me, I'd love to see Judith Schleicher and Chris Sandbrook debate Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion and some climate scientists. I think that would be worth paying money to go see, because I think that they would be awakened as to the youth movement that refuses to accept what they're about to inherit. And so when the social scientists criticize bold conservation plans, I guess I come back to what I started with earlier. What's your alternative to save life on Earth? Happy to hear it and discuss that. But give us something on paper other than just to critique other people's ideas without offering anything of your own.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my guest, the famed conservationist and scientist Eric Dinnerstein, and we're talking about a global deal for nature to save our living heritage. Your paper says, quote, in recent years, more than 60% of global emissions from natural habitats, which accounted for 15% of annual greenhouse gas emissions, stemmed from clearing and fires in just two provinces, Real Province in Sumatra, Indonesia, and Mato Grosso in Brazil. And, quote, that is stunning. Why can't somebody declare an emergency and act quickly to protect the atmosphere from these two top carbon hotspots?
Well, it's a really good question. And in the case of Real Province, there is a lot of problems with the spread of palm oil. The high price of palm oil is a strong attractor for different forces to go and clear land, sell off the timber, and then plant oil palm, which offers a very good return on investment. But what it also does in Riau is it shuts down Singapore and affects Kuala Lumpur and affects a huge swath of Southeast Asia from the pollution from those fires lit by those converting tropical forests. What's worse is that Riau sits on some of the world's great peat reserves. And you probably know that the last thing we want to do is to set forests above peat on fire, because those fires can continue to burn. And that's where a disproportionate amount of the world's carbon is stored in these peat forests, largely in the tropics, but also in the boreal forest of Canada and Russia. We want to keep that in the ground. So yeah, this is a huge problem. Now it's more than just those two provinces. There are others. But this is why I think, if anything that your listeners come away from this program, I would suggest that one of the most important moves forward is to break down the silos that exist between the climate scientists and climate science and the climate convention and biodiversity scientists and the biodiversity convention, because the two are so interdependent. We can't solve one problem without the other. We have to start thinking in tandem. And if we do that, I'm very hopeful that we're going to have a lasting solution that can lead to a thriving biosphere. But we have to start acting now.
Okay, now, Eric, what if we protect half the Earth by land and sea, and then pollutants like microplastic beads or toxic rain or nuclear radiation seeps through all systems? Can we really draw areas on a map and maintain barriers and rules?
Great question. And in fact, in the Global Deal for Nature, we have land-based targets, which you just referred to conserve half. And we also have policy interventions, so addressing plastics, addressing other forms of pollution that are pervasive, and that even if you established 50% protected on land and in the sea, it wouldn't be enough if you didn't have, for example, regulations. Let's go beyond plastics and consider a few more issues of great import. If we didn't have the effort to reduce or remove subsidies to fishing fleets that are basically mining the ocean, you know, we're conducting the greatest hunting expedition ever for top predators that goes on every single day. If we just established no-take zones in key protected areas around the world, we could have restore an abundant fisheries. So that's all possible. The other is, you know, just establishing large areas in Africa, as you probably know, doesn't do enough to protect populations of endangered elephants or rhinos or in Asia, tigers that roam over large areas. Is that we have to have strict laws and enforcement and incentive packages and local development around critical reserves so that we can maintain and even increase these populations of endangered large mammals, which is one of the first groups to go in the current extinction crisis. So I think that there's a lot that can be done on the policy side, too, with good enforcement. But it requires that we, you know, become much better stewards of the Earth, or future generations will never forgive us.
The global deal calls for us to save 50% for nature, but nature is alive everywhere, as you know, even in the middle of cities. Is half enough? And can we just pave over our share?
No, I think that we need to do conservation in urban areas as well, and there are some wonderful examples of that in cities and towns. You know, Alex, I've worked for several decades around the world when I was chief scientist at World Wildlife Fund and now for the last 5 years at Resolve. And in my travels in developing countries, I lived in the country of Nepal for 8 years. I've worked all over Asia and parts of Africa and Latin America. I've never heard once somebody say to me in a rural area, in a remote place where there's still good nature, I want to live next to a degraded environment. Nobody's ever said that to me. And I'm not being facetious here. Is I think that there's something really fundamental and there's an evolutionary basis to it, is that we all want to live next to a place that's attractive, that has clean water and clean air, that has healthy soils. That's fundamental to just about everybody. And I think that that's what we build on, is nobody wants to live next to a degraded environment. And even in cities, I think that people appreciate parks. I think the cities of the future will be a lot more greener than some of the cities that we have now.
This December, the latest climate conference, COP25, was just held in Madrid. How does the Global Deal for Nature fit in with the Paris Climate Accord?
I think it fits in perfectly, but I think that I articulated the challenge before is we have to stop thinking in silos. We have to think that the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis are deeply interlinked. Let me give you one example. If on the climate side, if we don't protect coral reefs, well, if we don't address staying below 1.5 degrees C, average global rise in temperature, and it goes to 2 degrees, it's not a linear reaction, so to speak. It's that the coral reefs essentially bleach out and die. When that happens, that there's approximately 1.5 billion people who gain their protein from tropical seas that involve reef systems and nearshore systems like mangroves. What happens to that protein source when the coral reefs disappear? And just that jump from 1.5 to 2 degrees can make that happen. Similarly, on the biodiversity side, we've had a long, long period of evolution where nature has shaped the evolution of these things called trees that not only form beautiful forests that sequester lots and lots of carbon and also provide all this habitat for so many rare species. What most people don't understand, and one of the critical aspects of conservation biology and its goals, is that many species on Earth are rare. Relatively few species are common. So what we're mostly trying to do is conserve rare species. And by rare, I mean species that are limited to a small geographic area, are relatively live at a low density, or both. And those are the things we target in the Global Deal for Nature, as well as the wide-ranging species that go on migrations like the caribou of Canada and Alaska, or pronghorn antelope, or other species out west, or the Serengeti migrations in Africa, is that these endangered biological phenomena are also critical targets. So from the narrowest range beetle living in the canopy of some Amazon tree to the caribou marching across the tundra, that's all part of biodiversity, and that's what we're trying to save in the Global Deal for Nature.
Okay, now, how can we do this? What institutions or what machinery exists to agree on this and to implement the Global Deal for Nature?
Now you're getting into the hard part. In some ways, it's easier to do the science and to articulate what we're trying to conserve in papers and to convince the governments to set aside more land. In some places, it's easy. They're already doing it. In others, it's a bigger challenge. But I think that we have to start thinking longer term. We can't think about just tomorrow and the next amount of profit we're going to get from cutting down a rainforest to plant oil palm and release all these greenhouse gas emissions that are going to make our planet unlivable. And so I think that some of the institutions are not quite, well, to say that they move at a glacial pace is a little exaggeration, but they don't move that quickly. And that's the biggest problem that I see, is that we have a timeline where we need to transition to, you know, completely rely on renewable energy by 2050. All the models pretty much point in that direction, and we need to conserve half of the land and half the ocean to avoid the emissions from land, and particularly things like permafrost, to avoid conversion or avoid, it becomes a feedback loop. We cut down boreal forests, the fires go up, the atmosphere gets warmer, and we end up with melting of permafrost. The plan that we have in the Global Deal for Nature seems radical to some degree for some people. But, Alex, you know, one observation I've made over the last few years where new climate models come out, no new model has ever suggested, you know what, you guys, you're overthinking this. You're way too concerned. Actually, the window and the timetable has been extended. We have a lot more time to try to get below 2 degrees C, and we can experiment with new technologies to do that. Just the opposite. It's the timelines are growing shorter with new scientific information. So my point is that what may seem somewhat radical today might seem conservative in 5 or 10 years when we get new models that probably tell us just how much faster climate change has accelerated over the last few years than we ever thought.
Well, we're running out of time, but last quick question. What were you working on when I called you up?
So I've got a number of different projects I work on. Aside from global biodiversity issues and trying to save life on Earth, it's a little more specific is what I talked about earlier of the extinction of large mammals in African reserves and reserves elsewhere that conserve wildlife. We've come up with the world's first end-to-end camera-based anti-poaching system, basically a burglar alarm for national parks that is very cheap. The batteries last for a year and a half, and it uses artificial intelligence powered by Intel, our close collaborators in this whole effort. It's called TrailGuard AI, and it's coming to a park in Africa very, very soon. I'm assembling them right now with my staff.
Sounds exciting. We've been speaking with Dr. Eric Dinnerstein, long known to the public as chief scientist for the World Wildlife Fund. He is now with Resolve, and you can find him at resolve.ngo. You can find the paper, A Global Deal for Nature, Guiding Principles, Milestones, and Targets, as a free paper at advances.sciencemag.org, or get the links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you for sharing all this with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.